shaking hands in a time of corona. Although one of the few things I do know about the COVID-19 disease is that it doesn't like heat. So I don't think we have a problem here today in Stellenbosch. So please shake hands and give hugs as far and wide as you want to, even to us afterwards, as long as it's outside in the heat. My name is Adrian Basson. Thank you for joining us. I'm the editor-in-chief of News 24 during the day. And I'm joined this morning, this afternoon, on this panel about our president, Cyril Ramaphosa. I must turn. Okay.
Can't see you.
They don't have to see me. Though, can
yes,
you?
They do. They do. Look in
is that
eye.
Better? Is that better? Okay. I'm joined this afternoon by two fantastic panelists with an in-depth knowledge of President Ramaphosa. On my far right, not politically, just logistically, Professor Anthony Butler, Political Studies, University of Cape Town, and author of Cyril Ramaphosa's biography many years before he became president, so he wasn't opportunist and wrote it overnight. He's always had a fascination and interest in the man. Anthony, welcome and thank you for joining us. And then closest to me is Cheryl Carolus, a veteran of the struggle, stalwart from the UDF to the ANC, former British High Commissioner in Britain for South Africa, businesswoman, chairperson of Peotona and Goldfields at the moment. Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us. Also importantly, former ex-chairperson of SAA, which will feature in this conversation.
And Deputy Secretary General Cyril of the ANC.
Deputy Secretary General of Cyril Ramaphosa, of course. Colleagues, I want to take us back in, as a start to February 2018. 2 years ago, just 2 years ago, it feels like a lifetime ago, but Jacob Zuma finally toppled as president of South Africa. Stepping down as president of South Africa after intense few days of negotiation, rumors of coup d'etats, Cyril Ramaphosa being sworn in as president of South Africa and delivering his first and famous Tuma Mina State of the Nation address in Parliament in February 2018. Tuma Mina, of course, a famous song from Brayu Masekela, and Ramaphosa quoted the words, "I want to be there when the people turn it around." Great hope, great euphoria in the country over Ramaphosa coming in, the great one who is going to take us out of the Zuma era, out of the lost decade of Jacob Zuma. Has he done this, Anthony Butler, 2 years later?
No. Thank you very much for inviting me and to everyone for attending. No, I think we all feel a sense of disappointment with what's been achieved over the past 2 or 3 years since the December 2017 conference of the ANC. The question is, which I think is raised by the general title under which we're discussing this, is whether this is because Ramaphosa has a long-term plan and that he's working steadily towards a better future for the country in accordance with a plan that he's formulated, or whether he is simply stranded and unable to make headway. And so the question for me is how we should understand that disappointment, that legitimate disappointment with what has been accomplished.
Cyril, what is your take? Where are we 2 years later? Are you disappointed in what has been achieved so far?
Adrian, I'm worried. And I think... Goeiemiddag mense. My ma draai na graf om ek groet die is mense. My Afrikaans is bietjie beter as Anthony se. Which is not hard. So yes, I'm more worried And you know, it's for the same reasons that I think in 1994, and even before the Cyril Zuma thing came up, where some people started saying something which still makes me hopping mad today, and that is South Africa's worse than anti-apartheid. I mean, like, anyways, don't ever say that to me, okay? But our thing as a nation is we are so easy to become hopeful, and that for me is the big strength that we must hold on to very carefully, because that is what is going to keep us believing that there is a better future. So let me say why I'm worried. I'm worried because, as in the post-94 era, we underestimate the extent to which things had been damaged and the fabric of our country has been damaged. And again, like Anthony, Salik ma baie kortlis, want ek sê ek wil ons facilitators as a job form doen. But I think there are serious challenges in the ANC itself. It's a viper's nest. Cyril staan naak daar. The stakes are quite high. We're going towards an ANC National General Council, which is a midterm review between conferences in August this year. And the knives are out. Cyril sit at the top six, and he can't trust one of them. He doesn't have one ally in the top six. We're sitting with an opposition, which is probably arguably worse, more fractured than the ANC even. At least in the ANC, there's those who are with Cyril and those who are against Cyril. In the DA at the moment, it's a free-for-all, and the EFF is not far from that. And far from being triumphant about that as an ANC person, I'm worried. Because when your entire ecosystem, political ecosystem, is in a mess and driven by all the wrong reasons, I think that's what creates a very dangerous landscape for Cyril.
Anthony, you've studied Cyril Ramaphosa intensely. He's youth growing up, his years at university in the Christian movements, then in the trade unions, into business, politics. There's an overwhelming sense I get, feeling from the South African public, that he should act with more purpose, more aggressively, more strongly, fire people, appoint people, close SAA. I was part of a team of editors who interviewed him on Tuesday at Tainé's in Cape Town. He unfortunately doesn't have a very open policy with the media so far, so it's one of the issues we addressed with him, because I really feel that he should be more transparent with South Africa about what he's doing. But during that session, when we asked him about this, he was quite strong in his answer, and it was the only time where he became, I don't want to say emotional, because he's not the emotional type of personality, but he spoke with passion, and he said, that's not my character. I am a consensus seeker. I am not someone who screams and shouts at people. I'm working to see consensus. Do you think it is for him hard to work in this kind of environment where we have pressing matters like a recession, our economy is in recession, like the non-prosecution of state capture and the uncapture of a lot of those institutions? Or is it just not possible? Is he really just that consensus guy who cannot act more forcefully even if he wanted to?
Oh, those are good questions. I think there are two ways of thinking about this. One of them is to look at what I think is a special quality that he has, which is an ability not to reach fixed positions on complicated issues. Mm-hmm. So I think he's able to suspend his judgment about how we try to address the Eskom crisis, but even on a bigger scale, about what kind of society it should be. Should it be a society that is a rampant capitalist society, or should it be a social democracy? So I think he doesn't push himself to take up positions. He surrounds himself with people who he then facilitates some kind of deliberation that reaches a consensus. But there's a negative side to that. And I'm thinking about when he was deputy chair of the National Planning Commission, there were very strong debates about what kind of development South Africa should be pursuing. And nobody could tell what Ramaphosa's view was. So he listened to everybody. He was very respectful towards people who were pushing, like Trevor Manuel, for rapid economic growth. And he was also respectful towards people who said, no, what we need is human development. We need better schooling, better healthcare. The impression that many of the planning commissioners left with was that Ramaphosa wasn't willing to take a position. And that meant that people couldn't form alliances or coalitions behind him. So he couldn't, in a sense, lead on the basis of his personal convictions about what should be done. And sometimes that works. So it obviously worked very well in the constitutional negotiations. It worked very well in the creation and the building of the National Union of Mine Workers, where most of the impetus for change was coming from forces in society. So he was marshalling, managing forces, leading people to work together who might not have done. But sometimes that's not what's needed. Sometimes the president has to say, we're going to try this way of solving the Eskom crisis. And that's magnified, that problem, by the way in which he keeps different constituencies apart. So I was very struck when I launched the first edition of the biography back in 2008, and a former general secretary of the NUM, the Mine Workers Union, who'd worked very closely with Cyril, he came up to me and said, we never knew about Cyril's past before he created the union. We never knew that he knew Bobby Godsall, the Anglo-American executive, before he joined the union. We never knew that he'd mixed in these elevated business circles. So somehow he has an ability to keep his constituencies apart, or he has had. But now that he's in the hot seat, it's become a different ball game for him, that he can't agree with people from the union movement and the mining industry about everything.
Cyril, I want to stay on this point and come to you. Tell us about the man Cyril Ramaphosa, the man you got to know during very difficult times where you guys had to do difficult negotiations, make very difficult choices before the end of apartheid and in those first number of years under Madiba. How did he come across specifically on this issue of making decisions? Does he know what he wants and ultimately finds a consensus way to get there? Or doesn't he know or change his view along the way? What was your experience?
Adrian, I concur. I think I concur with Anthony that Cyril, if anything, this title that you presented us with is something that I think is Cyril's strength. Cyril plays a long game and is excellent at it. I'll maybe look at the building of the NUM in a different way. I first got to know of and then made it my business to get to know Cyril Ramaphosa in the days when I was still a black consciousness firebrand, the sort of latter days of it. And he was starting to work with mobilizing mine workers, and I just raised my eyebrows and I thought, who on earth does this Ponzi lawyer think he is? Organized mine workers, really? And you know what? He actually did it. He did what it takes, and he slept on floors in places, and he did it. So, I mean, he pulled it off. The NUM, until recently, which makes me very, very sad, and it's something about the union movement I'm really very sad about, how people like Zwelinzima Mavavi, Owen Jim, and Gwede Mantashe, very central to both cases, Gwede Mantashe, in the fracturing of a strong labor movement. I know lots of people get hysterical. I love a strong, I believe you can't build a strong economy without a strong trade union movement. Because I believe the only way you're going to do it out of a difficult set of circumstances like South Africa is through good social compacts. And good social compacts are not made up of a dominant player. It's made up when there are people who each know how strong the other is. And the National Union of Mine Workers that Cyril Ramaphosa built was one that was strong. It was the biggest and the strongest union of COSATU, and in many ways the leader of COSATU. And but you could have a decent conversation with them about what had to be done in the mining industry. They were not pushovers. They were very well educated. And the other thing about Cyril is that he's an institution builder, so he doesn't strike deals. You know, he has a long eye. NUM, one of the things that happened under Cyril's watch that endures to this, there are many things. He insisted that every Secretary General of COSATU was going to get a degree. So, and that's how people like Gwede Mantashe, Frans Baleni, all are graduates today with MBAs. They understand the economy when they have a conversation with you. And that was part of Cyril's building. And it was part of a continuum with the Elijah Baha'i School, which is shop steward training and so on. And you look at the union movement today, that kind of training is missing. And that's why you have the kind of madness that you sometimes have. But that's also, anyway. So you know, and then the other thing with Cyril is that he, and it's a subtle difference that I tried to explain to somebody a few days ago. Cyril, one of his strengths and weaknesses is loyalty. Not to him, he's loyal to people who have walked through difficult paths with him, but it's not patronage. So he doesn't reward people. So, and that's part of why I think his team is lightweight at the moment. They're not fit for purpose because they are people who have walked with him, many of them, from the NUM days. You know, people like Elijah Baha'i or James Motlatsi, who's one of his closest confidants today, was the president of the NUM. And Cyril really, really trusts him and defers to him. James Motlatsi works very closely with Bobby Godsell now, resolving a lot of stuff that I'm associated with in my business world, because they can actually sit and listen to people from completely opposing views. So I think that I would come at it differently, Anthony, is to say that, you know, I think that, and, sorry, maybe just one other thing. Cyril is the first president from Madiba, Thabo, and Jay-Z in different, very different ways. He's doesn't have that same Machiavellian almost, you know, ability to strike a death blow. And I say this, you know, even Madiba, and as I say, Madiba, Thabo, and Jay-Z had it in different ways. But they were able to do it, you know, to just shut the door. I mean, I think that's where Cyril's loyalty thing perhaps comes in.
Zuma had a very blunt way of shutting the door.
No, Zuma was, I mean, you know, Thabo and Madiba was a very different sort of way. Zuma was very much based on patronage. Whereas with both Thabo and Madiba, completely different. I think I don't have a conversation about Thabo and Madiba now. But I think that that sort of Machiavellian streak is something that Cyril doesn't have. It's a strength and a weakness, you know. I mean, because I also think that Cyril is the first president that actually his game, his personal life game plan is not only embedded in politics with a big P. You look at the foundations of Mandela, Mbeki, and Jay-Z, and Mutlante. Cyril's is the only one that focuses on developmental things. It started off as the Shanduka Foundation. The two emphases was the Adopt a School Foundation and the Black Umbrellas, which is entrepreneurship of small startups. And highly successful, both of them. Very enduring things. And he's carrying that with him as he goes in. He chose not to make his legacy a political one. You know, the Mandela Foundation, all of these other presidents' foundations are narrowly focused on politics as drivers of their legacy. And Cyril's is different. And so, I mean, I think that Cyril is an institution builder, and that's part of his, I believe that's where success will come from, as an institution builder. Another thing which is happening right now, sorry if I'm getting on a bit, but and no, maybe we should tackle it under the economy.
Let me just on that point again, Anthony. One of the, it's almost become a joke, is that every time the president is shocked about something, you know, when he sees whether it's poverty or crime or I can't believe the last thing he was shocked about. And there's this, almost this feeling from South Africans, but Mr. President, how can you be shocked about something that we are living every day, load shedding, bottles, unemployment? Is this some indication to you, and having studied him, is he a bit out of touch maybe with reality and with what's going on in the country?
Well, I think the same criticism could be leveled at almost all of us, that we knew what was happening pretty much. So we were lucky enough to have a media that was reporting in real time the way in which the parastatals were being looted. And so, of course, Ramaphosa can't credibly claim to have been shocked, but who can? Especially within the ANC leadership. I think there is an issue there, that when you're thinking about a political long game, there's a very big distinction between thinking long term about how you are going to win and become president, and having an idea of what you're going to do when you get there. And some people argue quite convincingly that the qualities you need to become president are very much not the qualities that you want a president to have. Donald Trump has been a useful reminder of many of these issues. But it may be that there's an element of that with Ramaphosa, that I always had a sense when I wrote the first edition of the book that he always had an eye on the goal, the personal goal. In fact, I do mention that when he was a teenager, he was on a Christian camp. He was maybe 16, up north of Joburg, and when asked what he was going to do with his life, he said, "I'm going to be president." he was right about that.
At least he was very clear on one thing.
He was clear on the one thing. But it's quite striking. He had a couple of minor honeymoons. The first one was when he won the presidency of the ANC in that very narrow vote at Nasrec, which was a remarkable achievement, I think. And then Zuma was pushed out. It became clear then, he gave a good speech, but it became clear that he didn't really have a plan. So he had some general concepts about focusing on fixing the state and on encouraging private sector investment. But these were not really plans. So they weren't detailed plans in which he decided what were the mission critical elements, the things he had to focus on. What were the teams of people he had to get into government? Who did he have to get out? He more or less trod water. And perhaps a reflection of that loyalty issue again, he brought into his private office immediately around him people who had been formed in Shanduka environment or in relatively unproblematic contexts where the problems were less complex and demanding. Then he had a second honeymoon. So after the 2019 elections, he campaigned really hard, and his party was not very much behind him. And the ANC secured the best result they could have done, and they would not have done it without him. Again, nothing really followed. So the window of opportunity that he had, again, to present a real reform program wasn't used. And the thing about being surprised, he was there as deputy state president for a long time. You would have expected him to have been planning. Not just planning how to become state president, but planning what to do when he became president. And there hasn't really been an indication of that, still now. And it's easy to make this criticism because none of us are confronted with the range of problems and challenges that a state president is. But it's a real thing. And it is his vulnerability is that there may be people who have broadly similar political profiles to him, who maybe are better at getting things done, partly because they're more, what was your description? Machiavellian, yeah. More cutthroat.
Cutthroat. Cheryl, I wanted to comment on Anthony's harsh assessment that basically it's a president without a plan, and then talk about this mythical idea of a long plan again. The problem I have as a editor and journalist about the long plan is that we will never see it. So, you know, we can't judge him on it because we don't know what it is.
Yeah.
We will never know if he achieved what he set out to achieve. I do, however, want to say in his defense, to an extent, you know, when he says, I want to be there when the people turn it around, the things he referred to and that he has spoken about in three sonas now is fighting corruption. He has set up a new directorate in the National Prosecuting Authority. He's given it money to appoint new prosecutors and investigators. It's not his fault if they don't arrest and charge the people. He cannot interfere in that realm. Secondly, he has set out ESCOM as a great priority of his term, and probably, and I want to ask your views later, probably what's going to be his legacy is going to be ESCOM. and he has set around SOEs specifically, but in particular ESCOM, in turning that around. He has appointed a new board. One of the first things he did was to appoint a new board, to appoint Andre de Reiter as CEO. You're stable there. You have
a
plan.
That's a very dodgy question to ask.
You have a plan with that mic. A long plan. There we go. He did replace the boards at Transnet. Mm. I think almost the first thing he did when he came in was appoint Popo Molefe at Transnet, brought in Jabu Mabuza at ESCOM, who's now left since again, brought in a new board at Denal, and started initiating processes at SAA, which you chaired. So I think it is a tad unfair to say that he has no plan or that we don't know what he needs to turn around corruption and he needs to fix the SOEs. Is that basically the plan?
No, I would... look, I don't know, but I mean, I agree with you that I think that we sometimes forget what has actually been achieved, you know? Not that we should be complacent about it, but also we forget that it's not dependent on the president whether Jacob Zuma gets arrested or not, or whether people pay back the money. I mean, he can just create the right institutions, and I think his work is done well on that within his own powers. And the other thing we mustn't forget is that, you know, one of the biggest fights we had against Jacob Zuma was his total disregard for the separation of powers and for the rule of law. That he broke down consciously the agencies that had to, the law enforcement agencies. So now I think Cyril's done well on that front. And I do think that we can be, part of why the fight back is getting so strong now, and not just in the ANC, but the alliances between elements, Jacob Zuma's elements in the ANC and the EFF, they're seeing those orange overalls. And I mean, but the president can't arrest, and the president can't tell the hawks who they must arrest. They must arrest the people on the base. Now, this is where I want to throw the ball back into your court. All of us are there. You know, we can actually, Albie Sachs said to me the other day, the thing about our constitution is you've got to use it or lose it. And I must say, I'm very proud. I can say I played a very strong role in removing Jacob Zuma in various ways. And I plan to make sure he goes to jail. I can also say that I have been part of working with a treatment action campaign to get antiretrovirals to people when I was still had a hard political hat on. We worked on the Komape case, Michael Komape case, the child who drowned in the toilet. We can do things. And I mean, that's the point, is that we have these marvelous institutions, we have great rights, we have a constitution with a Bill of Rights. There's nothing that exists in the law. We have to establish the jurisprudence. Our constitution gives people the right to housing. We had to take the Grootboom case from right here, Kelsrefie, people here, Mrs. Grootboom, to assert that right, the government, to give the law life. The right to a dignified education and the fact that a toilet that your child can drown in is not that, had to be established. It's not in the law. It can't be taken for granted. And so we must also use it or lose it as far as the Constitution and the rule of law goes. But as far as, let's get back to Cyril and the long game. The one thing I want to agree with you very strongly, I phoned him with that, he gets very irritated because I keep on calling it a cow, that bull thing that he had, not bull, not the bullshit thing, that proper bull. What was it? Some beautiful animal. A buffalo, yeah, a buffalo.
Ankola, cows.
I called him up and I said to him, why don't you actually explain yourself? I think as a public, people deserve this. Since those days, I've been having these fights with him. He said, you know what? For people who choose to believe that story, I actually owe them no apology. I said, well, I don't know the story, and now you told me what the story is, because I also thought it's outrageous. Like, how can anybody spend that money on a cow? You know? and just for the record, I mean, Cyril actually is part of breeding disease-free cattle. And he works with people all over Africa, including President Museveni in Uganda and so on. And they actually, it is quite remarkable what they're doing. The farmers amongst us here might have some insight into that thing. It's like science. It's a whole bunch of stuff, young scientist programs. But it goes with everything else, Adrian, that I said to him, Monday, you know what? That actually just smacks of arrogance to me. Because why do you think you shouldn't explain yourself to the public? I do want to know, and I do care, and I don't just buy any bullshit. That's why I'm phoning you, but most people can't phone you. And so, like, one of the things that he is doing very well at the moment is the revival of NEDLAC, because I referred earlier to the only way we're going to pull this economy right is through a new set of social compacts. And there are four players in it. There's obviously government and the state. There's labor, and labor not at the expense of the masses of unemployed people, because that's always a danger with trade union movements, is that they can in fact work in ways that can work against unemployed people. The state, labor, business, and big business in particular, because they dominate the economy, and then civil society broadly. And so, and for me, the institution that has not been used and not destroyed, just been dumbed down, is NEDLAC. When NEDLAC started out, the president used to open every session of NEDLAC. Every minister who was supposed to be part of things was there for the whole 2 days that NEDLAC sat. Today, they send deputy director generals. I mean, I chair Goldfields, which is one, it's a large gold mine, a global gold mining company. We have to really say to the CEO, no, you're going to start going. You can't just send the HR director or somebody to NEDLAC. And so that's now being revived. They just appointed Lisa Seftel to as the new director of it, a public servant of note. Every first Monday, the president meets with the NEDLAC players, with those stakeholders. Now, NEDLAC has lawful powers to intervene in the law-making process and in the policy-making processes in the country. It's just been, by default, it's been allowed to just fall by the wayside, so people fight their battles on the streets. And the president goes every Monday. He was just there on Monday again. He doesn't say anything about it. Now, I mean, do we know about it? And that's where they discuss about ESCOM, they discuss about the bandwidth problems that people have.
Spectrum, yeah.
The spectrum problems, the red tape problems, whether it goes anywhere, I mean, I don't know because I'm not there. Mm. Even I heard by the wayside that he's still pitching up every month. First Monday every month he's there. And they sit and they get report packs. And the person who told it to me was a cabinet minister who is of the better class of person. And he said, actually, he gets much better account of what is really going on and who's not doing what in those meetings, because the other social partners can confront the ministers who come there. They can't come and bullshit away in the way that they can in the cabinet meetings, you know, and the cabinet agenda is crammed with everything, whereas there they focus on a particular set of things. Whether it's going to work, another story. The question of getting some Vuma into generally around Cyril, I do think. I think Cyril needs to act, and I mean, as I said, it's not really, oh, sorry, maybe a last thing I'm going to say. I think there's a nonsense about Cyril must choose between the ANC or the country. He can't. You know what? If you are elected by your party to be the president, your party can also unelect you as the president. So you're not going to go anywhere. And that is why people like myself in the ANC believe that we have to recalibrate the ANC. But it's not just the job of ANC people, you know, because it's in every one of our ambits to ensure that, firstly, we take an active interest in politics. How many of us actually hold our ward councillors to account at the local council level? And where the rubber hits the road is at the local council. What happens in Kamnandi and the hostility that builds up between people Fani Dorp and people Fani Ona Dorp and Mensa Baiteri Dorp? That's local council stuff. And how many of us who feel perplexed about this? Heck, you know, the law says that ward councillors must hold ward meetings. We were just starting to do it there in Melrose, in my middle-class suburb in Joburg, where we were summoning our councillor. And so there's a lot of ways in which we must be active in politics in our country, and we have quite advanced ways of doing that. So I want us to really get out of the status mode, because I think but we can talk about that, sorry.
Cheryl, I must say I'm very glad to hear that there's someone who has the president's number who can call him and call his BS, and please keep on doing that when he doesn't talk or does say crazy things. Anthony, but now we've raised an interesting topic, which is this fact that Ramaphosa must now first survive in the ANC before he can execute his long plan, if there is one, for the country. We're almost halfway through his ANC term, going into 2022 ANC conference, and I guess September 2022. And we're already in this fight-back mode. We've spoken about it. Cheryl says it's quite fierce. I do think there's disputes about how fierce and how strong it is, but there's no doubt in my mind that there's people campaigning against the president actively. How strong do you think this fight-back campaign is, with specific focus on Lithuli House, where there's a lot of people now coalesced who are not pro the president? And what does that mean for the president's, the next few years of his term as president of the country? Is he going to be sidetracked the whole time whenever he wants to go on a trip or do something to rather stay and attend to an NEC meeting where he could potentially be recalled?
Yeah. I'm a bit skeptical about the fight back argument. And it's quite convenient for Ramaphosa and the people around him to claim that there's some kind of fight back from a Zuma faction underway. In fact, the ANC's factions are very fluid, and once you lose, people desert you. Unless they feel there's some potential advantage in negotiating their way out of prison. So you'll notice that many of the Zuma era crooks have gone very quiet, and I anticipate that many of them will eventually be prosecuted. Some of them will be. But of course, the vast majority of people who acted illegally will not be prosecuted. So I think there is an element of negotiating your future, regardless of what Cheryl says about, I mean, we don't know how the prosecuting authority is going to select cases. And I believe they are not going to tell us on what basis, given that the head of investigations at the prosecuting authority has correctly said there is an impossibly long list of potential people to prosecute. So there's a lot of politics around that issue of prosecution and punishment for the Zuma era. What's more problematic for Ramaphosa is there are people who have essentially the same political constituency as him who may feel that he needs to be removed. So that the way we might put it is that the thing we called the Ramaphosa faction at Nasrec that was never loyal to Ramaphosa, that they may choose someone else from among their number who they feel will be both more effective at getting things done and more effective at prosecuting a group of of protecting a group of people from the repercussions of their actions. And obviously one thinks of people who were nominally part of Ramaphosa's campaign, like Paul Mashatile, people like David Mabuza, the deputy president, who appeared to have done a deal with both sides. So he did a deal with the Zuma camp and with the Ramaphosa camp. These people are perhaps more effective than Ramaphosa in their own eyes and in the eyes of many other people in the country, and more flexible with regard to ethical issues, more accommodating of wrongdoing. So I think to the degree there is a challenge to Ramaphosa, it's more a challenge from the people who supported him last time round. But I still don't think there's very much possibility of organizing a coalition to remove a sitting president at the next ANC conference in 2022. It's really, really hard to build a nationwide coalition in the ANC strong enough to propel not just a set of candidates, but a whole slate into a new leadership position. So I don't think it will happen. And because we don't have a presidential system, we have a parliamentary system, there isn't that strong a leadership halo. There isn't really a mandate for Ramaphosa because we didn't vote for him. But in our system, over time, you accumulate loyalists in key positions. So I think I saw an advertisement for DG in the presidency a couple of weeks ago, and for chief operating officer. Now, Ramaphosa's been a little bit slow there, but you can see that he will make sure that these people are his people, one hopes. And over time, that's happening across the public service, in the boards of parastatals, across senior ranks of government departments, in agencies, in the hawks, in the police service, that gradually people who are more in alignment with Ramaphosa's values are securing offices. So I think think about Mbeki and Zuma. Mbeki, I must admit, I've never had a very soft spot for. But by the time he got to the end of his second term as ANC president, he decided he was going to carry on and run the country from Luthuli House. Zuma, who was a very weak president in his first term, by the time he got to the end of his second term, he didn't want to go away either. And it was pretty hard. Thank you, Cheryl. It was pretty hard to get rid of him. It required quite a wide-ranging coalition to stop him from continuing to exert power. And that's my feeling about our system, is that the same is likely to happen with Ramaphosa, that he'll become more and more entrenched in power and harder to get rid of. Whether that means he'll be able to accomplish much is a different question.
Cheryl, I want to stick to the issue of Luthuli House. I know we're moving fast here, but I think it's important. How important is it for the president to keep some sense of control over Luthuli House? Because I'm sorry, but if I look at the individuals who runs Luthuli House at the moment, Ace Magashule, Jesse Duarte, who flip-flops every second, every 24 hours, Nomvula Mokonyane, Malusi Gigaba, these are not fans of the president, and they are now out of the public eye, and they may, as Anthony said, be kind of their careers may be waning, or the opposite may be happening. They may be plotting.
No, in fact, I do think, Anthony, I think that, Adrian, that one of the, and it's very similar to 94 as well, you know, I think we underestimate what it takes to run a democratic state. And that's government and the departments and all of that. And if you want to staff them up with people who understand your game, and I think one of the things that Cyril made a mistake in was he took all those people with him into government. And he's got no one who's got his back in, not very many people who's got his back in Letuliaos. Many of the positions like SG and all of that, those are elected directly by conference. Cyril can't fire them. He's got them until the next conference. The Secretary General has huge powers. But one of the things that he has not asserted sufficiently, I believe, that Jacob Zuma used to be very good at doing. Well, Jacob Zuma used to know exactly, remember Gwede was his SG, and they were not very good friends. He used to walk right over Gwede, and he established people in the presidency, and he took powers into the presidency. And I think Cyril has been using, to his detriment, his usual soft power in the presidency. Very invisible, very... Whereas, in fact, the ANC constitution gives him a lot more power, which Thabo Mbeki was very good at using in a better way, you know, around policy, shaping of policy, around communication with the public. And now you've got Ace Magashule, who is, I mean, a man of ill repute. So I think that, that is a problem for Cyril, that precisely because... If he does not have the ANC on side and does not drive the ANC agenda, he's dead in the water. And this conference coming up now in August is a key one. So I agree with Anthony. I think the chances of them floating a credible candidate to replace Cyril is not. But what they are doing very successfully is in fact playing, and this is why this conference in August is so important, they're using policy to hamstring Cyril completely. Because some really crazy things came out of that conference at Nazareth, like questions around land, around the Reserve Bank. And half of Cyril's term has been spent just writing that, getting to a point where he's got the constituencies on his side sufficiently to be able to go to this conference in August and assert that that... Because this conference is all about policy review. How far are we? Now, he's got to be able to go there with enough confidence that he's got the backing to say that was maybe a bit impractical now that we've actually looked at this thing.
This. I want us to delve into policy, just two of them quickly because we're running out of time. Anthony, the land issue, very topical since he came into power. So at the Nazareth conference, one of those resolutions Cyril referred to was expropriation without compensation. What is your review of how he has handled that so far, and what do you think is his long game on land?
Yes, that's a difficult question.
It was a long pause.
Yeah, I think he's handled it as well as could have been hoped. I mean, fortunately, he has a good deal of knowledge about commercial agriculture, and fortunately, the resolution passed at Nazareth did add a series of significant qualifications to the resolution about it not damaging food security and the viability of commercial agriculture and so on. And I think the direction in which the policy has been steered is quite promising. And the land issue in South Africa is a predominantly an urban land issue. And looking around this city, you can see that the issue, just driving here from my home in the peninsula, you can see what the issue is, and it's more than half of the population, two-thirds of the population, living at a very significant distance from work opportunities. And we have lots of land that is occupied by, not by farmers, it's occupied by golf courses and municipal land and Transnet depots. So we have significant land that has not been available, made available in our cities for housing development. And that's not just because of the land question, but the land issue is a real one. And I'm hopeful that the expropriation policy will move primarily in that direction, towards the land issue that, in my view, really matters. There's a lot of symbolic importance to land in rural areas, but I don't think it's a priority for many people living in South Africa today to have access to rural land.
Cheryl, I want to end our session before I open for questions to the audience. Another extremely important policy discussion which the president's going to have to lead with the unions in the next few weeks is firstly on the Eskom debt deal, where a deal is punted to use pension money of the members of the unions, but this deal comes from COSATU, so there's a bit of a contradiction there, and to find some kind of social compact at NEDLAC, where this discussion is on the table, according to the president, in the next few days or weeks. And secondly, with the public wage bill, where we've just heard the Minister of Finance, I thought, giving a very sober budget speech and saying that this is all we can cut now, and we have to cut from the public wage bill. In his ideal world, not by cutting jobs, but by cutting the increases of civil servants. Of course, massive reaction already by the unions. How do you see the president leading these two social compact discussions in the next short term?
I think that if it just depended on him, it would go well. And I think something, any of you who haven't read I just picked up Max du Preez's Vrye Weekblad thing. And he's actually written a good editorial. And I think but I was saying to Anthony, he doesn't understand Afrikaans. I said to him, he's actually written a script for us in many ways. I literally read it while I was sitting outside having a vleis pastei and a coffee. You know, the problem with one of the challenges that's real, civil servants feed a lot of mouths in this country. So that conversation can't just be crassly held. You're going to have to understand that everyone. We went through this debate in 1994 when we shut down the Bantustan governments. And I know today still some people believe that we were unnecessarily brutal only on the Bantustan, i.e. poor black rural communities in that cutting. So, of course we're going to have to cut that wage. It's just not on. How we get there and what we consider in that process. Please let us as South Africans spare a thought that it's none of us who have or feeding 10 mouths. It has to be done, and that's why there has to be that social compact. I have no doubt that the president will have it. My fear is not with the president. My fear is with a fractured labor movement and with an opposition that is so bankrupt, all of them, the whole damn lot, the DA, the EFF, everybody, in different kinds of ways, that the only policies they have is, in fact, an anti-ANC policy. They don't really have answers for the fractures that our country's in. So I'm glad that it's in NEDLAC. I hope that we can, in fact, rebuild our fractured labor movement. I think our president, directly or indirectly, could probably play a role in healing those rifts, because I think the tenure of Gwede Mantashe in that place was not one that's glorious. I think because his leadership style is much more antagonistic and brutal. So, but I think it has to be done. I think there's no getting away from it. But I think we're dealing with people's jobs, and that's something which I appeal to us as a nation to remember, is that every one worker we retrench is probably supporting 10 people. So how we do it and how that unfolds and how we, it's not just saying to somebody, right, there's your severance pay, you know.
Anthony and Cheryl, thank you so much for your time so far. I'm now going to open the floor to the public. If you have a question, please put up your hand. We do have a roaming mic. I see two hands already. Just wait for the mic, please. Thank you.
Or a comment. People mustn't dress up their comments as a question either. They can just say if they want to say that.
I see myself as skoon. Ek gaan in Afrikaans praat, dit is makliker vir my. Ek kom van Woester af en ek is nou op die ontvangkant van al hierdie gesprekke van die regering wat nou bo is en al hierdie onderhandelinge en alles wat u vandag vir ons nou hier gesê het. Maar ek praat namens, ek is in die onderwijs gewees 100 jaar gelede, maar nou werk ek met een van die jongdochters van Zwelle Temba, wat een swart woonbuurt is in Woester. Maar wat my bekommernis is, is die onderwijs. Het voel vir my al die staf daarboe is aan die aangaan. En die mens aan die onderkant kry nie die aandag wat hy moet kry nie. Ek gaan eenmaal een week Zwelle Temba toe, ek gaan haal my huis op daar. Elke week as ek daar kom, sit die kinders buitekant die skool. Ek neem foto's, ek het hulle al 4 of 5 keer aangemeld by Obos. Ek het iemand gaan sien daar, wat baie besorgd is daaroor, wat gesê het, dit is totaal onaanvaardbaar, die hekke is gesluit. Die kinders sit buite met hulle foon, hulle kom aangestap, my huisel kan Koza praat, sy is 'n Koza, maar ook Afrikaans baie goed. Ons vra vir hulle, wat maak julle? Nee, hulle is laat. My vraag is, hoekom is jy laat? Is die skool of te swak met sy disipline? Het die kind nie vervoer nie? Of gee die kind net nie om nie? Waar woon die kind? Ek weet nie. Al die vraag is vir my van uiterste belang, want die kind sit buite. Ek neem dit af. Ek sit met die footage op my foon. Ek bel hulle, ek meld dit aan. Daar kom onderwyser uitgeruid, sy karret. Ek stop daar, onderwyser sê, hulle ken die reels, 10 uur maak hy ek oop. Toe ek het aangemeld het, die volgende keer, het die spoorhoof buiten gestaan. Goed, hy kyk nou seker wie dit is wat laat is. Paar weke later, selfe storie, kinders sit buiten. Ek kom daar op 'n Vrydag, wat gaan aan op die ander dag? Dit word nie opgevolg nie, daai kinders sit buiten. Een matriekleerling wat 'n B gekry het in haar matriekjaar nou, het in haar matriekjaar in haar tweede kwartaal 'n 2 gekry vir haar sy nie meer syberwiskunde nie, die ander ene, ek moet nou nie eers mee wat dit noem. Toe gaan sien ek 'n persoon daar by Obos. Ek neem haar resultate, hy kyk na haar resultate, hy sê hierdie dogter is een van die 10 beste in haar graad. Sy sit met 'n 2 op daai vak, sy moet gaan aansoek doen vir universiteit oral. Hoe, wat maak sy met 2? Hy kyk toe na al die kinders se punte, hy sê, 2 is die gemiddeld, 1 of 2. Hoe is dit moontlik na 5 die vorige kwartaal? Ondersoek gaan gedoen word, en gekyk word, hoekom is die kind se punte so swak? Daar is nou probleme, die meneer of die juffrou het opgedaag nie, swak aandag gegee. Ek stel nou 'n probleem op grondvlak vir u, wat vir my werklik van ernstige belang is. Die kinders sit buite, en waar kom die babas oor 9 maande vandaan? Hulle verdwyn in hulle ma se huise in, want hulle werk by ons.
Ek dink ons het daarvoor baie, baie dankie oor die onderwys. Kom ons vat nog 'n vraag of 2 voor ons na die paneel te terugkom. Ek sien 'n hand voor en 'n hand agter. Begin my voor, dankie.
Baie dankie. Don't you think the real issue has been this February budget, that was the game-changing event in terms of decision-making by the president? That in a couple of years from now we're going to look back at this watershed moment, the willingness of a union president and an ex-Labour minister to take on the very powerful unions, that this isn't going to be the start of a much more decisive policy making in the next few years, and that the president really feels a lot more confident about his own position within the ANC as a party. Don't you think that was a game-changing event?
Thank you for that one. Anthony, I'm going to ask you to think about that so long. And then the last question at the back. Thank you. Sorry, we can't hear you, sir. Just hold a second. We're almost there. Thank you.
As you can see, if you see from my age, I'm always in a rush. I don't buy green bananas or long life milk anymore. I know you don't want comments, but questions. So I'm going to disguise a comment as a question. Don't you think that we have reached a stage where we have had expectations and we now have to get over the expectations? Don't you think that even from the beginning we should have known that Cyril Ramaphosa is going to be a disappointment? That's the question I'm asking you. And I'm on the side of the liberal politics in South Africa. I've been on the side of Ramaphosa all my life. But you sit with politicians. Mm. I don't see a plan, frankly. I don't see the long game plan. I see no game plan at all. Now, after we've accepted that, this is then my question. Mm-hmm. Don't you think that Cyril made Cheryl made a very poignant remark in saying that we will have to take things in our own hands. The business sector, the social sector, everybody in this country will have to play a significant role. The politicians are not going to do that. And my remark at the end of this is, be realistic and accept once and for all that Cyril comes out of the union world. He was never really a businessman. Tell me, when was he really a businessman? I don't think he knows the business principles that well. And he's going to continually disappoint all of us. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you very much. Those were three very interesting and diverse questions. Cheryl, can I ask you, the first was obviously a comment from someone who's at the cutthroat of our education system. Can you just do comment on your take on the education system, the people who head that up, and maybe something about Ramaphosa in that space?
You know, ek kan net sê ek stem jou hartiglik saam met die dame wat die punt opgebring het. I do think that education, fixing the education system, is one of the cornerstones almost to fix our economy. We're not going to do it without education. So and dis hoekom ek vir u sê, en die ander ding is die dat the most sustainable way to break the cycle of poverty in a family is by educating the children in that family. And so ek stem heeltemal met u saam, maar die probleem met education is education, the strongest power lies in the province. And that means simply that all our provinces are failing our children. Doesn't matter who's governing the province, whether it is the ANC or the DA or the EFF or whoever. The fact that children are sitting and that teachers are unaccountable is shocking. Ons kan miskien 'n gesprek later oor dit, but the point is the president has very little power. The Minister of National Education, the constitutional power she has, is to determine the policy framework. Whether an MEC acts against a principal depends on whether the premier of the province acts against the MEC and what the premier puts in there. So that's a problem. Health and education, the two things that really get me fired up, because it's the dignity of the poorest people in our country, is so dependent on those two aspects. And that's provincial powers. We've got to hold premiers and MECs accountable for that. Local government, not in education, but in health, definitely. So ek stem heeltemal met die dame saam, dat dis onaanvaarbaar. Ek het 'n suster wat nou in Desember afgetree het as 'n skoolhoof, 48 jaar, op die Kaapse vlakte. En die dinge wat in die skool aangaan, maar haar resultate, omdat sy 'n goeie leier is. En enige onderwyser in high school staan nie 'n katse kans om te hulle te gedra soos die mense wat u sê by die skool wat eens wil het Themba sien nie. En maar daarom dink ek ouers moet ook verantwoordelikheid aanvaar, en other than this is just my one comment I do want to make. We've become far too statist as a nation. This notion of service delivery, I think, must be replaced by accountability. We must stop, you know, service delivery is for me such a demeaning concept of self. Like you're waiting for Father Christmas to come with a bag of goodies. And I know some people, for right-wing reasons, get irritated about service delivery demands. But everybody says, whether it's poor people in the township who complaining about the water that's brown out of a tap, or us middle-class people in the suburbs who complain about the kind of things we whinge about every day, you know, it's ultimately, we can't just see government as the only party in ensuring the quality of life we want, because then all we do is we wait, and if then we say, no, we're not happy with what you've delivered to us. How about just becoming more active, as I say, through things like ward committees? But you were, sorry, what was the other thing about Cyril, whether he... one other thing to the gentleman at the back. You know, the other party in this who escapes our scrutiny every time and year too is the private sector. Whether it was in state capture or whatever, there can be no corruptee if there isn't a corrupter. How many of us make the same noise that we make about Jacob Zuma and Ace Magashule and Malusi Gigaba, about KPMG, about Bain, about many of these places? I can promise you, it's like if we don't pay a bribe to a cop, then we have to start off by not having more than one glass of wine every time we go out. But because we insist on drinking and driving, and then we don't like the thought of going to jail, so we pay a bribe. So we build that system of corruption and the death toll on our roads. We have the blood on our hands. And similarly, if we want to stop state capture, we have to hold those big businesses, because it's not the hawker on the street who captured the state for Jacob Zuma. It's in fact right up to the London capitals of many of those companies. And it's not just Bell Pottinger. It's KPMG. I mean, all the names.
McKinsey.
McKinsey. These people that we build out, that build all our systems again, the German people. SAP, yeah. I mean, we've even forgotten who they were. You know, but we haven't forgotten Ace Magashule, and we haven't forgotten Jacob Zuma. And without them, Jacob Zuma would have had nothing to capture. He would not have been able to capture. But the capture happens around big contracts that go to private sector individuals. Let us not forget that part.
Great, great end, note to end on, Cheryl, from you. Anthony Butler, can I ask you to wrap by responding to the two last questions? So the one, a very optimistic view of President Ramaphosa and his finance minister, Tito Mboweni, that maybe this budget speech in Sona was a sea change. This was them confidently into their plans. And then a bit more pessimistic view from the back about, you know, why did we have any hopes? Ramaphosa is just a politician like the next one.
Yeah, I didn't read the budget speech in quite the same way, partly because soon after the speech, Ramaphosa indicated that he would like a negotiation of the kind that perhaps Cheryl would favor, but I wouldn't, in which there's a compromise reached, and perhaps the reduction in the public sector payroll is accomplished in a negotiation through a social compact of some kind, and that the ESCOM crisis is resolved in the same way. And I think that's likely to not to work, because the compromises will be reached on the basis of transactions between different parties protecting their own interests, rather than on the basis of some plan for how resources should be used in the public sector. I think the same story has been true partly in the attempts to address all of the state-owned enterprise crises. And Cheryl said something about one public sector salary feeds many people, which is absolutely right. But I think there's a more important phenomenon, which is the building of a middle class, a black middle class, through the parastatals and the public service. And that is it's a historic undertaking. I mean, it's very similar to the building of an Afrikaans middle class through the same parastatals and through Afrikaans financial institutions and companies 7 or 8 decades ago. And cutting middle managers in SAA is fundamentally attacking that class creation process. So it's really a very, very costly political act. Alongside which, of course, we look at the ANC's probably increasing dependence on donations, as we like to call them, donations from people who are in the supply chains of, particularly of parastatals. So the ANC itself is tied up into a system of transactional politics in which resources are exchanged for power and continued access to resources, which means it's very hard to go anywhere fast without a president who knows precisely what he's doing. And on that, we look at the people who have taken the flak for Ramaphosa, particularly Pravin Gordhan, perhaps Tito Mboweni in that speech that you talked about. I'm not sure what the relationship is with Gwede Mantashe anymore of Cyril Ramaphosa. But these people who have been very close to him in government have wildly different views about the direction that the country should go in, and wildly different assumptions about what might work. And they're all on the way out. So I think we need to pay more attention to the real ANC, which is an ANC that is moving into national leadership positions from provinces. So the provinces are generating the new leadership of the ANC, and the people that, who have succeeded in provincial politics are successful rent seekers and patronage politicians. They're people who have worked out how to extract resources from the provincial fiscus to distribute it among people who will support them within the ANC. And whether we're looking at Paul Mashatile or Didi Mabuza, Ace Magashula, this is the probable future of the ANC. So Ramaphosa is the last of that generation of ANC politicians like Cheryl, who came through national structures, SACP, trade union movement, exile politics. The new generation of ANC leaders is coming through provincial patronage and corruption politics. The people who are good at that stuff are the people who constitute the vast majority of the membership of the National Executive Committee and will increasingly dominate the top six positions.